T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage.
Engage. Approach Enterprise. Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes. Fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Failing frequencies open, sir.
There it is. There's the new opening. We've been promising you that for a while. I love it. I love it. It's exactly what I want it to be. Thank you to everybody who has been harassing me to request a new opening. Not that the first opening wasn't any good, but the new theme to Engage, I think, better represents the show. It better represents the vibe of the show that I'm trying to create, which is a vibe of, what is it called? 60s kitsch on the big CD of all the different sound beds you could use, with a little bit of there's a little bit of Star Wars in there, right? A little bit of Star Wars and a little bit of Man from U.N.C.L.E. or Mission Impossible, who knows? But more importantly, we finally get to hear from Scott Bakula as Captain Jonathan Archer, a man with whom I hold in great regard and great respect. Jonathan Archer, that is. Bakula, I don't know. But we've always loved Archer, and he just hadn't been in there, and we apologize. And also, we've got where no one has gone before, right? Because, Next Generation made that change, and now we've made it, too. So we got it. We got the new opening, everybody. It's a big show. Big show today. We got a big show. We've got the new opening. And we have a great interview lined up with our friends, Denise and Michael Okuda. This week, available to you in stores and through various online outlets, you can buy the newest iteration of the Star Trek Encyclopedia, which is, if you have the old encyclopedia from the 90s, put that aside. Put that in the junk heap of history. The new one is here. It is big, it is gorgeous, it is hardcover. If you look at the pages from the side, it's color-coded by letter. It has a beautiful, it comes in binding, and it is massive. It's two books. It's two books, over 1,000 pages, and it weighs a lot. We're going to talk to the Okudas about this. And if you don't know who Michael and Denise Okuda are, they are... I don't really watch baseball, but I think they have, what do they call them? Clutch players or utility players, like swing players, people who can do anything. What do they call that in baseball?
Yeah, utility.
Utility. I think the Okudas are the utility players of all of Star Trek. They've been involved in Star Trek since the mid-1980s, originally in the graphic design department, and then slowly became involved in sort of making, the Bible of the technology, the technobabble of sort of like keeping a record of like how all the things on the ship work, and now are the archivists more than anything else. They are the official archivists of what officially you call every little gadget, every trinket, every species, every alien, every space-borne parasite in Star Trek. And they are involved in, listen, if you ever buy any of the Blu-rays or DVDs, they're always involved in behind-the-scenes stuff, both from a technical aspect as consultants, but also they're interviewed and they do a lot of the commentaries. And these are just two very important people in Star Trek that are not as well-known as some of the other creators. And we're delighted to have them on the show today to celebrate the release of the new remastered, revised, rebooted and expanded Star Trek Encyclopedia, the hefty, mighty tome, which deserves a place on your shelf. So take some other things on your shelf and move them around and make way for the new encyclopedia. It's also an exciting week because, red alert, we have a new sponsor. Yes, a new sponsor for the show.
Accomplished.
We have a new sponsor that is going to help us keep the lights on here on Deck 44. Let me tell you about Eagle Moss. Eagle Moss is a dynamite company that produces high-end but yet affordable models. And they do it not just, they do it for all sorts of things, for DC, for Marvel, for various military Michigas, but the jewel in their crown is what's called the Official Star Trek Starships Collection. And Eagle Moss's Official Star Trek Starships Collection is now the sponsor of a new part of the show, which I just thought of a minute ago, which is called, we're going to call it Dry Dock. So this week in Dry Dock, we're going to talk about one of our favorite ships. Well, if you sign up to Eagle Moss, and there's a special page you can do it, st-starships.com/engage, because the first, if you do that, is a special deal. It's a bi-monthly thing. You get these models sent to you in the mail to make your desk look awesome, and the first one is only $4.95. the first one you get, ladies and gentlemen, I don't mind saying it, you get the D. You're going to get the D. The first one you're getting is the D, the Enterprise D, Captain Picard's D. It's coming to you through the mail. And it is the best starship? Well, I don't know about that. That's open to debate. But if you stay with Eagle Moss long enough, and you can cancel any time, but you get two a month, it goes deep. You're going to get Zindi ships. You're going to get... you're going to get a Harry Mudd's ship. You're going to get a lot of these cool ships. But here on the Dry Dock, we're going to talk a little bit about the D. What is it about the Enterprise D? NCC-1701-D, Captain Picard's flagship, USS Enterprise, Galaxy Class. Where was it constructed? Do you know? Well, the Eagle Moss version is done by a highly skilled artisan using painstaking the detailed painting and modeling and resin work. But of course, the Enterprise D, constructed at the Utopia Plenty Ship Fleet Yards in Mars. Launched in the year 2363, Captain Jean-Luc Picard had over 1,000 crew, and it was the first one to have a bar, 10 forward, deck 10 at the front. Get to look at the stars as they warp past you. And the first one that we ever saw separate the battle bridge from the saucer, which, by the way, is a topic that we're going to discuss with Michael and Denise Okuda later on today's show. But before we get to that interview, please, please, for the love of God, for the love of your own awesome desk, make it better. Go to st-starships.com/engage. Check out the Eagle Moss models. And I tell you, they're the greatest thing, and not just because they're sponsoring the show. I thought they were cool long before they started paying us. I swear to God that's true. I've always wanted these ships. I don't actually have them myself, but I've seen them, and they really are cool. You know what else is cool? Our Denise and Mike Okuda, who took time off from the busiest week for them because the book is coming out this week, and I said, I want to talk to you guys. So we woke them up early in the morning. They're out there on the West Coast. And we had what I thought was going to be a 30-minute chat, and it turned out to be an hour chat. That's the way I roll sometimes. And I feel bad because at first we got on, it's like, we really only have about a half hour. I said, no problem. If you got to go, just let me know when you got to go. And then we talked, and when I thought we were done, we hung up, and I looked up, and I went, oh, my God, we went exactly twice as long as I said we would. So I apologize to the Okudas. But nevertheless, why don't we just move on over then to that conversation, which we recorded just a little while ago, because it's an hour, right? And, you know, you're driving in the car right now. You know, it doesn't take you that long to get to work. So why don't we get to the interview right now, and we will talk more soon.
Welcome
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back, and this is exciting because our next guests are, you know what I love about Star Trek is its discussion of meritocracy. You know, if you're good, you wind up just doing what you do. And my understanding, and we're going to ask these guys more about it in a moment, is Michael and Denise Okuda started in Star Trek production in the graphic design department. And then when somebody's good, you use them for everything they've got. And they have sort of morphed and evolved into becoming really the record keepers of Star Trek and also the interpreters of so much of the technology. So you have art and design on one hand and the hard science on the other. How can two people be involved in both? Because they're great. That's how. So let's beam them in. Hold on a second. They're in the matter transporter chamber right now. Hold on. Oh, yeah. And Denise and Michael, welcome to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. How are you?
We are good. Thanks for beaming us in.
I think we're all here. Yes, it looks like we're all here.
You know, there's the old question. When you get beamed, do you die and do your atoms just regenerate, but it's not you, like the ending of The Prestige? What's your take on that?
The way that the description of beaming is written, I would go for you die and you're reconstructed.
Whoa!
What I wish we had written is I wish we had done some kind of dimensional transfer thing to be less ambiguous.
Okay, because this is something that I never thought about. I just assumed, yeah, you get zapped over. And then as I got a little older, and I think if you read James Blish's Spock Must Die, there's a lot of, which is non-canon, so let's get that out of the way. There's a lot of thought to, it actually isn't you that's transported over. Denise, what's your take on this?
It makes my head hurt, so I just don't even think about it.
Awesome. Well, speaking of, it makes your head hurt to think about it. It makes your back hurt to lug around the new Star Trek encyclopedia, because how many pounds is it altogether?
11.
Yes. It's amazing. Now, the reason why the Okudas are on the show, and we've been wanting to get them on for a while. And by the way, you and I, we've sort of met in passing over times at conventions, but it's always been like, oh, hello, nice to meet you, and we'll talk later, and then it never happened. So I'm really glad to have you on the show now. The encyclopedia, the first version, was a mere 400 pages. A mere 400 pages, nothing. How many pages is the new one, the revised edition, which is out this week?
Over 1,000.
Yes. In small print, with many, yeah, many photographs.
Over 1,000 pages, smaller print, so the actual number of words is way more than twice.
When we first started, they thought that they didn't want to do a two-volume set, and they asked if we could cull it down, and we basically said no. So they relented, and they said, okay, we're going to do a two-volume set, hence the 11 pounds.
Yeah. Well, it's a thing of great beauty, and for Star Trek enthusiasts, it demands a spot on your shelf. It is a big, bold presence, and I did not bring it with me to the studio today because it's really heavy. You know, once you get it, if you order it on Amazon or one of the other places that bring it to you, good, make the mailman bring it to you. And then when you get it, you put it up there, and then you take it down off the shelf regularly for consultations. So it's very exciting. Congratulations to you guys. But I do want to do a little bit of a history of both of your involvement in Star Trek, but real quick, since the idea to revise the encyclopedia and today, which is, you know, literally it's in stores this week, we're recording on a Monday, the 17th of October, how long were you working on this newest iteration of the book, which you worked on decades ago?
Well, this version took about 2 years, and a lot of that was full-time. It was our full-time job. The encyclopedia is a tremendous undertaking. We hadn't updated it since 1999. So about 2 years of our lives went into this book.
It's one of those things you think, gee, I'm working on a Star Trek. I mean, it's a Star Trek book. I get to watch Star Trek episodes. I get to read Star Trek scripts. That's got to be a lot of fun. And the truth is, it is a lot of fun. But at a certain point, it's a stupendous amount of work. and you find yourself going, why did I agree to do this?
And so we always say we are happy that it is written and finally out.
Yeah, it's done. And now you
done.
Can... You can take a deep breath and try not to think about Star Trek for a little while, even though it is something that's been in both of your lives for a long, long time. It must infect your dreams, right? You must dream about Bajorans and Betazoids and Benzites.
No, I think we dream about production because for so many years, I mean, that was our job. And so it's very different watching Star Trek or doing research for a book than our day job was, which was production. So yes, we may dream about Star Trek, but it's not about Star Trek. It's about, you know, production.
I got you.
You know, at the same time, now that the book is done, we can actually sit back and pull the thing down and thumb through it and go, oh yeah, that's why we were doing this. This is fun.
Well, it really is. I mean, it's a beautiful, aside from being heavy and large and demands the presence on your shelf, it's beautifully packaged. There, the paper quality is nice. The photos, there are so many photos. When you get to volume two and you get to the letter S and you start getting to ships, you know, just the amount of information of every ship that's ever mentioned on the show gets its own little notification, and then there's also, you know, every insignia, every badge is there in beautiful, bright colors. You can really scrutinize something that you know, is only worn on somebody's chest for 30 seconds in one episode. You can really stop and look at the design of that, which also, that has to have a special place in your heart because that's where so much of your work in Star Trek started, was with I don't want to say graphic design, the design elements, you know, working on insignias and typography and little, as they say in film school, the mise en scène of the show, you know, the stuff on the screen. Can you talk a little bit about how you first started in the design aspect of the show?
Well, I started out like a lot of people as a kid watching Star Trek, loving Star Trek. And when I was young, I discovered a book written by Stephen Poe and Gene Roddenberry called The Making of Star Trek. And to me, that was a huge revelation. I suddenly realized that in addition to the...
Uh-oh.
There was a parallel series of adventures by Gene Roddenberry and Bob Justman and Matt Jeffries and Gene Kuhn and other heroes who were doing equally amazing things to make the show happen. And as I started working, as I graduated from school, I realized that I can do some of those things. So I was, in fact, working in very low budget television commercials and corporate graphics. And on a whim, I sent in a portfolio and a letter to Paramount, and expecting entirely to hear nothing. But I figured you should try it because otherwise you'll regret it. And to my utter shock, I got a letter back I got a phone call from Ralph Winter, who was the one of the producers on Star Trek 2, 3, 4 through 6. And he said, he left a phone message for me saying, gosh, we're already staffed up in Star Trek 3, but if we ever do a Star Trek 4, I'll give you a call. And I thought, well, that's the nicest brush I've ever gotten. And to my utter shock, 2 years later, he called me up and said, hey, we're doing Star Trek 4. Do you want to work on it? So I had to think real hard, and I said, yeah.
Absolutely. What was in that portfolio that you sent him? What that led them to think that yes, this is appropriate for Star Trek? I mean, certainly, you know, it would have been, oh, this is a great designer, but what was it that you think was in there that made them think, ah, yes, this is the guy that knows the future?
I didn't try to be the guy who knew the future. What I did was I looked at their set. If you recall the Star Trek, the motion picture bridge, had all these round screens on it. And I thought, well, if you have a round screen, logically, it would have been designed to show certain kinds of graphics. What kind of graphics might those be? And how could you produce those graphics quickly and inexpensively? And that's what I sent in.
So was this, were these drawings or were these computer, like simulated computer displays?
This was in the dark ages of computers. This was entirely pen and ink.
Okay, so you were doing pen and ink drawings of what computer graphics would look like.
Yes, that, with very rare exceptions like the Genesis effect, very, very few of those computer graphics back then were actually computer graphics.
Right, right. So when somebody's screen would, I don't know, Star Trek the Motion Picture, when Chekhov is firing into the asteroid in the wormhole, that was actually designed and drawn and animated. That was not done computer generated, correct?
That was done with conventional backlit or cell animation. So yes.
Wow. And something that you don't even think about today when you're watching movies, whether it's, you know, you just assume that it's done with computers.
Well, now computers are this odd combination of not only is it faster, not only is it better, but it can be quite a bit cheaper. So as soon as we could, we started using computers on Star Trek Next Generation for computer animation. And by the time we reached Voyager, we're using computer design for virtually all of the graphics, the control panels and signage and everything.
Right. So Michael, your first gig with Star Trek was with Star Trek IV, which was incidentally the movie that turned me from a moderate fan into an insane fan. But if you poke around the internet, Denise, you predated Michael with Star Trek because you were in that famous shot, those famous scene in Star Trek the Motion Picture, where everybody is on the deck with our friend Bijo Trimble, who we interviewed a few weeks ago. You were there that day. That's becoming like one of these, like the Rage in Harlem day when everybody, all the jazz musicians were there. All the important Star Trek people were there that day. Is that not correct?
That's correct. Gene Roddenberry was so gracious. He said that he wanted to reach out to fans of the show and give them an opportunity to be extras in this rec deck scene. And I got a call from a friend and showed up. And I mean, there was a cattle call. You had to be selected. And I remember being pulled out of the lineup and being told that they wanted me to be a Vulcan. So of course, I said, sure, and, you know, went in for fitting and wardrobe and then showed up on the day of the shoot, reported to makeup, became a Vulcan. It's hard to see me. I'm on camera.
Camera right.
About three or four rows in. I'm wearing a brown uniform, but I'm there.
I can spot her instantly.
Yeah, I'm there.
Well, so
it was an amazing, amazing experience, if you can imagine, because I was a huge Star Trek fan.
Well, that's what I was going to ask: is how did you, you know, what was your credentials to be an Uber fan at that point? How were you involving yourself in the Star Trek community in 1979?
Well, back then there wasn't the internet as we know it today. And so I was really on an island. I loved the show. I grew up with the show and didn't really know that many people. I had been to a couple of conventions. Bijo Trimble did some early conventions in the mid-70s, and I had been to a couple of those. But I was a huge Star Trek fan, but pretty much on an island. I didn't belong to a community. And again, the world is totally different now. And so it was quite an amazing experience.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Star Trek IV. So Michael, you're now, you know, on part of the crew, and your initial work in that was working basically on the computer screens, like we discussed earlier, and that sort of design work. How did it sort of morph into, because you were involved in sort of writing technical manuals that would ultimately help the writers understand, you know, how exactly warp drive works and things like that. I mean, once Star Trek IV happened, you continued to work on Star Trek pretty much all the way through till today.
Well, what happened was we had a great art department for Star Trek The Next Generation. We had our production designer, Herman Zimmerman. We had conceptual designer, Andy Probert. And we had another artist, Rick Sternbach, who was the other illustrator. And particularly Rick and I were huge sci-fi geeks. We were also huge fans of the real-life space program. Neither of us are scientists, but we're big science nerds. And we started writing memos unsolicited to Gene and the writer, saying, you know, this could be this or that could be that. And we kind of learned how you make suggestions. You don't say, this is really dumb. You certainly don't say, you need to change everything. What you need, you learn to say, this is what you want to do. This is what the writer wants to do. Here is maybe a slightly better way to do that. And the writer started appreciating it. So we started doing it more and more. And finally, by the time Mike Piller was executive producer, he formalized it and gave us the title of tech consultants. And from that, Rick and I wrote the Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual. And from that, Denise and I wrote the Star Trek chronology. And from that, we wrote the encyclopedia.
Awesome. So it's a snowballing effect, really. But so give me if you can remember, what was the first thing that sort of like techno babble-ish or scientific point that was like kind of bugging you and then you had the guts to mention and that the writers incorporated? Was it something to do with warp drive, or was it something to do with deflector dishes, or was there something where you just said, it would just make more sense if it was this way? Do you recall what sort of the first big victory for you was?
Well, my first victory turned out to be a defeat. In the first episode, Encounter at Farpoint, one of the coolest sequences was the saucer separation scene.
Oh yeah,
but I thought it was hurting itself. I thought that by having Picard saying, "Oh my God, we're going to separate the saucer. Stand by to separate the saucer. Prepare for saucer separation. Saucer separation in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1." I thought we were killing the drama when it actually happened. Absolutely unsolicited, and I had entirely no business doing this. I wrote a note to Gene saying, you know, wouldn't it be better if he said, prepare for battle configuration or something like that, so that when the actual separation happened, it was a visual surprise.
Mm.
And Gene very kindly wrote back and said, that's a great idea, we'll do that. But then it turned out a few days later that for whatever reason, of just the logistics of script writing and distribution, that he had to not do that.
Oh, I see.
But to have Gene say, "Hey, that was great. That was quite a rush." The first big victory wasn't really a victory. It wasn't really a technical thing. Was Herman Zimmerman and Andy and Rick were struggling with trying to come up with a design for Geordi's visor. Now, this wasn't my area at all, and I certainly had my hands full, but I knew deadline were coming up, and they were coming up with all these great designs, but Gene just wasn't happy. So I was staying with two friends of mine in Los Angeles, because I had just moved to Los Angeles, Jeff and Kiku Annan. And Kiku had a hair clip on her dresser.
A banana clip.
And I said, "Hey, can I borrow this?" And she said, "Sure, why?" I want to show it to them at work. So I brought it and I showed it to Herman Zimmerman. I said, "What if you use this as a texture on the visor?" And Herman looked at it and said, "I think you just may have solved a very difficult problem."
Oh, wow.
So he had it sent downstairs, had it painted, rushed it over to Gene's office, And 2 days later, Gene sent me a bottle of champagne.
That's awesome. So, you know, when somebody's got a good idea, if it comes from a different department, never say no to a good idea, right?
Exactly, as long as you follow the chain of command.
Right. So, Denise, can you tell me when did you come into the Trek world on a more formal level than just being in the in that one shot in motion picture?
Well, Michael knew absolutely no one in Hollywood, and I knew Michael. And I actually was working as a registered nurse and met Michael because I was brought up to consult with the art department on the look of the sick bay of the future. And then I met Michael. Actually, I met him because he had a Max Headroom puppet on his bulletin board, and I loved Max Headroom. I thought it's a brilliant show.
It really is. And I was going to bring that up later. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm glad you brought that up.
Anyway, it started a conversation, and we started dating. And if I wanted to see Michael, because he was working on Star Trek V, I had to basically come to him on the weekends I had off. So long involved story short, he kind of taught me the ropes, or at least as much as I could get done in a finite period of time. And then when Star Trek VI, the feature Star Trek VI came along, Herman Zimmerman, whom I had met, basically hired me as a production assistant. And from there, I was hired as a full scenic artist on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So my first adventure was the feature Star Trek VI, and then I was brought on as a full member of the, joined the union and became a scenic artist, graphic designer for Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Fantastic. So at that, and then at that point, you were doing similar work together in terms of, you know, graphic design and set design, but then also got involved in writing these technical manuals. So the two of you both sort of have, do you consider it a left brain, right brain sort of intermixed chamber, or is it just, this is what you do? Is it something that you just do everything and that's all there is to it?
Well, I think that both of us, Michael said he wasn't a scientist. I believe he is a scientist. Both of us have a passion for science. And we kind of look at the world that way. So it is right brain, left brain, but it seems to work. I did not write the technical manual. I couldn't even go close to the technical manual. One of my favorite stories is Michael was up very late at night, which is not unusual. And I came into the study and I looked over his shoulder and he was writing a nanosecond by nanosecond what happens to you when you transport. And I looked at that and I laughed and I said, you need to come to bed. But, you know, it is a right brain, left brain. We don't seem to have any problems integrating. They kind of go together.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting because the look of Star Trek is an artistic endeavor. I mean, I know that you were both very involved in just the creation of the type of fonts that are used and sort of, you know, on Deep Space Nine, you know, what a Cardassian computer console looks like and things like that. You know, you wouldn't necessarily think that the same person that would be creating that would also be writing the minutiae that's found in the Star Trek encyclopedia. I mean, it takes a very specific type of person to be able to do both of that. And it's amazing that these two people also happen to be married to each other. So it's definitely definitely a nice mix. Let's put it that way.
Well, all of those things require people who know and respect the material. And because we both come from loving Star Trek and having delved into it most of our lives, That's really the foundation of it all.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
Let's talk now about the updated version of the encyclopedia, because it's a big deal. First of all, it did make a little bit of news, and we've been talking about it on this show since we started in June. We've been referring to the new films, the trilogy of new films, as the Kelvin universe, the Kelvin timeline, because that was something that you worked out for in this version of the encyclopedia. And I think it's a brilliant way of referring to it, not the J.J. verse, the Abrams verse, or just the reboot verse or anything of that. Can you tell me a little bit about the eureka moment of coming up with that description? Because I think it's just terrific.
It wasn't really a eureka moment. What we did was our first, if there was a eureka moment, it was the realization that you could simply deal with the Kelvin timeline as an alternate universe in the same way that we did the mirror universe or different futures. And if you spoke of it in those terms, its place in the Star Trek pantheon becomes very clear. And once we did that, we knew we needed a way, a handle to refer to it. It needed to be something that was in-universe. It needed to be something that gave equal weight to this timeline as well as the original. We didn't want something that was even slightly snarky.
Yeah.
But we wanted it to be something that came organically out of the universe. So we actually delved over for quite some time. We first wanted to name it for the sun, for the nova that exploded that triggered the events. Except that star never got a name in the movies. Now it got a name in one of the graphic novels. It was the Hobus, and that's not a bad name, except that if you didn't get that particular graphic novel, you're not going to know what it means. So if we called it the Hobus timeline, then every time we called it that, we would have to footnote it.
Right, right.
And so that wasn't going to work. And then we thought, well, maybe Spock was the one who went back, so maybe it was the Spock timeline. But because Spock has so many other meanings in the Star Trek universe, that would require footnoting. So we contacted John Van Sitters at Serious Consumer Products, and we said, hey, what do you guys call it? And he goes, well, we don't really have an answer. So we said, let's send a note to the folks who made the film. And, do they have a nomenclature? Because it's one of those things, it doesn't hugely matter what it is. You just need, it needs to be respectful and it needs to be consistent.
Right. And it didn't really matter until the creation of this book, really, which is going to be like in stone. It's like, oh, we all have to get literally on the same page here. So you contacted the creators
and got no help from them in that department. And it's one of those things they never had to deal with it, because they were dealing with essentially a completely separate entity. So of course they didn't have a reason to ask that question. So finally, the one thing that it was one of the triggering events. It was something that even if you're casually familiar with the 2009 film, you knew was the Kelvin.
Right.
And so we ran it up the flagpole, and nobody had a problem with it. So that's what we settled on.
And we figured it must have stuck, because we started hearing about the Kelvin timeline way before the book was published. And so, to our minds, John Van Sitters at CBS Consumer Products liked it and shared it with the folks doing other product. And it just became what you call the J.J. Abrams universe now is called the Kelvin universe. So,
right.
We're pleased. We're happy that it now is succinct and everybody's on the same page.
It is perfect, because it is respectful, and it's also, but it makes sense story wise. Like when the 2009 film came out, and Alex Kurtzman and Bob Orsi were doing interviews, and you know, kind of when people would say, wait a second, why did in the original Star Trek it went like this, but in your movie it goes like that? They would say, hey, destruction of the Kelvin, that changes everything. It really is the principal moment. It's Nero going back in time, blowing up that ship. Who knows what kind of butterfly effect blowing up that ship has on everything else. So, yeah, the Enterprise is built in Iowa and not in space dock. Maybe, who you know, why? Who's to say why not? Because whoever was on that ship got killed, made something else happen, and now they're building the ship on Iowa, and you can't argue otherwise. So it when I first heard it, and it sort of like took off like wildfire on Twitter and whatnot. It's like, we're calling it the Kelvin timeline now. Didn't take a minute for me to think why. I had the Eureka moment on your behalf. I shouted Eureka and threw my laptop in the air. So
yeah, there you go. I hope you caught your laptop.
Absolutely. So go ahead.
Actually, if you watch the film carefully, there are moments that predate the destruction of the Kelvin. So if you read our somewhere in the book, I forget where, we wrote that obviously this caused ripple effects up and down the timeline. So we're trying to cover all the bases.
Hey, don't try to corner me with logic, sir. I like this idea and I'm sticking with it. How does that sound?
No, we're very happy to have helped figure this out.
And also a little commentary from my side. Nobody should call it the Abrams verse anyhow, because Justin Lin made the best of the three movies anyway. But that's just me. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. Now, the other big thing about the book, and it's consistent with the previous version, is you do not, and this will maybe ruffle a few feathers, you do not include the animated series as official Star Trek Encyclopedia canon. Because it would then be, instead of 1,000 pages, it would be 1,500 pages. So that's one thing. But did this give you any sleepless nights, or are you okay letting the animated be its own thing on the side?
We're okay with it being on the side. Yeah, we thought about it, and yeah, it would have added pages and things like that. But at the end of the day, it was, as we understand it, it was Gene's request. It was Gene's wish, so he's no longer with us, but he was the boss.
Yeah, it really wasn't our decision. I think the most that was our decision was, even though 2 years sounds like a long time, it really wasn't. I mean, we hit the ground running. Once we knew this was going to happen, and there were still discussions going back and forth, we've done this before. We know how much work it is. We know that you have to devote your time consistently, and we just started working. I mean, we didn't wait, and because quite frankly, we were frightened. It was 2 years, but we knew that it was going to take every single day, and we were going to have to treat it as a full-time job, which we did. Mm. So to add yet another layer of complexity, really, we didn't want to do, and since the marching orders came from other than us, continue, don't include the animated series. We were going good, because now we have half a chance of making the deadline.
And it also, go ahead.
At the same time, there are things we love about the animated show. And
absolutely.
For example, when we worked on the remastered original series, Dave Rossi came up with this brilliant idea of putting the Vulcan city from yesteryear into a couple of the matte paintings. We loved that idea, and we did that, and we used that in the encyclopedia. On one of the never before seen ships that we added to the remastered was based on a ship from More Tribbles, More Troubles. Mm. It's this really interesting ship design that I absolutely love, and we put it in there. So it's not that we don't like the material. It's just that that's just the way it worked out.
And also, where does it end? I mean, because then you start saying, well, some of these novels are really great and they have been referenced in later films or later shows. So it becomes an amorphous thing at that point.
I mean, well, that's true. But that actually hits upon one of our hopes for the book, that, we have friends who write novels, and we hope that this will serve as a reference to people who are writing books and reading books, that this was in the show, and whatever you take out, take off from it, where whatever directions you want to go, that's cool. We love it. But this material.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, if one wanted to be a, you know, a jerk about it, like, why do I need to buy this book when I have Memory Alpha, which is, you know, the online database, which is all sort of user submitted content, which is voluminous. And, you know, if you were to print out everything in Memory Alpha, it would be 100,000 pages probably. Part of what makes this book so important is that there is a succinctness to it. Each entry is just as many words as you need to get the point across and to be precise and to give you all the relevant information and include a really nifty picture. And it really is a perfect reference guide because it cuts away, you know, if you want to go further, you can do further research, but it's getting to the heart of the matter. And I just wanted to ask you guys both about, you know, how hard it was pruning each entry to just as few words as needed to get the point across.
Oh, you're one of the few people who actually understand. Yeah, that actually is a challenge. You know, what's important? What would be cool, but is, yeah, we want to put an extra paragraph into Spock instead of this.
Right. And,
every bit of information is competing against everything else.
There's also the conversation of, you know, what do you include and what don't you include? There is very little, correct me if I'm wrong, there's very little real world in there in terms of production. For example, William Shatner does not have an entry, but you do have entries for each individual episode. So, you know, City on the Edge of Forever has an entry, but William Shatner doesn't, but certainly Captain Kirk does. So I'm just curious about the conversation about where you involve real world versus, you know, fictional world.
The basic conceit of the book is that we imagine that the two of us live sometime in the future beyond the time of Star Trek, and you're looking back on what these things happen, and that's the basic conceit of the book. We, in those terms, yes, we shouldn't have put the episode titles in there, but we decided that those were useful, that people are going to look up City on the Edge of Forever. And also, when you look up City on the Edge of Forever, we can have cross-references that say, okay, this was the guy that zapped himself, or this was the drug that McCoy took. So that was a violation of our metaphor, but we think it was a useful one, and at the end of the day, you want it to be a good book.
Hmm. Well, I can help you retcon this, because if you're from hundreds and hundreds of years in the future, these stories that our characters go through will be discussed as events. So the events of involving going back and meeting Edith Keeler is just called in common parlance, oh, that's City on the Edge of Forever. We all know that story, and that's why somebody would look it up that way. How do you like that for a retcon?
That's exactly what I meant to say. You put it perfectly.
But, you know, another really cool thing in there, and just by thumbing through it, there's 100,000 cool things in there. You have, you know, I just randomly stopped in the letter P, and you have an entry for predestination paradox, which is a sort of a sci-fi trope, but it comes up a lot in Star Trek. So it gets its own entry. You know, there's a lot of little nooks and crannies like that. I'm curious about the conversation that the two of you had about what to include that was kind of like that, like story elements as opposed to, you know, a specific ship or a specific weapon or a gadget or something like that.
In the case of predestination paradox, that term was actually used in dialogue in the episode Trials and Tribulations. So that one was easy. But we tried to approach it as if we're researchers there, and what do you want people to know? What if you're in the 25th or 26th century, what's important about Picard? And sometimes that takes you in different directions. For example, the character of Rom in Deep Space Nine, in the early drafts, he was just Quark's slightly slower brother, and that was his character. But at the end of Deep Space Nine, he became the Grand Nagus of the Ferengi Alliance. So if you're in the future and you're writing about the guy, what's the first thing you need to know about him? He was Grand Nagus. So you try to say what would have been important to someone in that future.
Mm. I like that. I like the idea of looking at Star Trek as something from the past in the way, you know, which leads me to think, of course, you know, 50 years from now at the next anniversary, they'll probably still have paper in some capacity. Somebody will be updating this book again for the next 50 years. That's the hope anyhow.
Well, Michael and I like paper. I mean, we certainly, you know, use our computers every day for multiple reasons, but there's something about sitting down with a book that we consider to be very special. And this is a reference book. This isn't something that, you know, you would read, probably not read cover to cover, but this is something that you may see an episode and you go, oh, I want to learn more about this. Or my favorite episode is The Inner Light, and I want to know, I want to look at that episode and I want to read all of the definitions in that episode. So, like I said, there's something to be said for paper and there's something to be said for holding a book. And we're very pleased with the way the encyclopedia turned out.
What a lot of we've heard from many, many friends and fans, what they do is they keep the encyclopedia by their on their couch by the television, and it's something that they thumb through while they're watching the show. You go, oh, that's that episode. Oh, wait, what was that guy? You look up that guy, and as you're reading about that guy, you find out something else, and you go to another entry, and it becomes a rabbit hole. But it's a deliberate one. What you're hoping is not just a reference, but a way to explore Star Trek that's a little bit different from actually watching it on television, that you can take a guide or a random or a selected exploration of whatever part of the Star Trek universe you want. And we find ourselves doing that now that it's actually out in paper. We can just kind of thumb through it and you just kind of lose yourself.
Now that it's done, you can enjoy it. So Yeah. So I would I don't know for certain because I haven't done the deep dive on it yet, but I would imagine that there probably are a couple of Easter egg jokes in there, maybe, because there certainly are some on the acknowledgments page. Is that something that we should be looking around for, or did you play it pretty straight once you got past the acknowledgments page?
We mostly played it straight. Oh, what do you think is an Easter egg on the acknowledgments page?
Well, there's two. There's actually more than two, but let me dig up the picture I took. One is the photo you use on the acknowledgments page. On the left, there's like a matte painting shot. And it's from the Menagerie, from the remastered version. And if you look at it long enough and you think about it and you go, why is this picture here other than all other pictures? You realize it's because the two of you are in that shot. Did I figure that out correctly?
Yes, exactly. and it's in the remastered Menagerie episode. Michael and I and some of the folks at some of the artists at CBS Digital, we borrowed some costumes, some uniforms, and they photographed us, and we are peppered throughout the episodes in the remastered episodes. Michael is, I think, piloting a shuttle in Journey to Babel. If you see this red stick, that's me, you know, off in the corner looking through a window. That's usually me because I had a red dress uniform on. So yeah, absolutely. And we just thought that was kind of fun.
Absolutely. And then also, if you look on the thank yous, I mean, there's the usual, you're thanking the people that helped you get the images and people that work at the publishing company and at CBS and blah, blah, blah. And then you have, it's not even its own paragraph. So you really have to be reading it. And why I was reading it, I don't know, but I was. I must have had a sense that there was something in there. There is, after the special thanks and the extra special thanks, there's inspiration by, and you start listing a bunch of names. And it took me until the, well, on the second name, I said, wait a second, something's up here. And then I kept going, oh, wait, this is all a big gag. So you have some great names from, not even just from science fiction, just cool people in general. So I'm gonna read them, and you can maybe tell people who are listening who these people are. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Okay.
Because the first one I had to look up. I was very embarrassed. There's only two on here that I had to look up. I didn't get. The first one is Alice P. Liddell, L-I-D-D-E-L-L, and I am humiliated to realize I didn't know who that was. Does everybody know her by that name and I'm just a dunce, or is that something that you kind of have to know a little bit of extra history?
Some people know it, and some people know that Alice P. Liddell was the little girl who inspired Lewis Carroll to write Alice in Wonderland.
So what I want to know is which of these names came from Michael and which one came from Denise, or were they both came from both of you? Was there harmony on each one, or were there some picks that came from one or the other?
I think this one came from Michael. I can't remember, but I think it did.
Okay. The next one is Ford Prefect, which was
The Hitchhiker's Guide.
We both.
Absolutely. That was when I went, hey, wait a second, Ford Prefect, I know that. The third one is a cool name, but again, if it's bundled in with a bunch of other names, you wouldn't necessarily realize that it was a fictional inspiration. Is Susan Calvin.
Susan Calvin from Isaac Asimov's iRobot stories.
There you go. The next one, Haywood Floyd, but not Dr. Haywood Floyd.
Yeah, we should have made it doctor.
We should have made it doctor. One of our, if not our most favorite movie in the whole world is 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yep. You know, I just saw it again in 70mm in New York. They had a special projection.
Isn't that striking? We've seen it a couple of times in 70. It blows your mind away. That was made in 1960. Was released in 1968.
Yep.
I mean, wow. It's never been. It's incomparable. It's just amazing.
It is probably my favorite movie of all time. And
yeah.
if you haven't seen it yet, and if you want to, as it happens, just a few weeks ago, we did an interview with the director by the name of Matt Johnson, who made a movie called Operation Avalanche, which is probably still playing out in Los Angeles where you are. You guys might hate it because you guys work with NASA sometimes, which we didn't even talk about on this show. It's a mock documentary about faking the moon landing, believe it or not.
You're right. We wouldn't like it.
But it's done in a very pro NASA way. It's very loving. You got to trust me on this. But part of it is the movie, which is done mock documentary style. They gate crash Shepperton Studio and gate crash the shooting of 2001: A Space Odyssey. So there's
that sounds like fun.
That's fun.
Yeah. No, you got to trust me on this one. It's a really interesting movie. Okay. So moving on from Dr. Haywood Floyd, Logan 5. I think everybody knows who that is. Logan 5, of course, was from
Logan's Run.
There you go. Margaret O'Keefe from
A Wrinkle in Time.
Was one of the, were these so far from both of you, or was one of them, were any of these one like, no, I really want to have it in, and the other one was like, no, that one's silly, but you did it anyway?
Well, they're all a little silly.
But why we put them in is they all had profound influence on really both of us. We're very fortunate that Mike and I think so much alike and have so much in common. I mean, it's Wrinkle in Time, we both read as children, and if you haven't read it, go read it. They're actually a big budget motion picture right now. They're in pre-production on A Wrinkle in Time, but go read the book. It's absolutely magical.
Yeah, everybody read the books. When the movie comes out, you can say the book is better.
Well, I'm sure it will be better, but I'm looking forward to the film as well.
Well, you know, you never know when they take something that's a classic and then they make a movie of it, it's where they, if they depart from it in an interesting way, sometimes is the best way to do it. You know, if they try to do a one-to-one transfer of the book to the movie, that's always where it's a failure, at least in my opinion.
Well, we'll see what happens.
We'll see.
Making telling a movie story is a very different art form than writing a book, so it always has to vary to some degree.
Other names, let's see. No, we're not going to go through every one of the inspirations here. You got to buy the encyclopedia yourself to read them all, but just Valentine Michael Smith is on there because you couldn't grok Spock before Valentine Michael Smith.
And Robert Heinlein.
And Helena Trimble. So this is one that I had to think about. I must admit that it took me a minute. Helena Trimble was a character from the Questor tapes and was named that because, obviously, of Bijou and John Trimble. Was that your way of giving a hat tip to them, or was it to the character, or just to a little bit of both?
Well, both, absolutely. But we loved the Questor tapes, and we were very sorry it never went any further than the pilot, basically, or the TV movie. Again, if you haven't seen it, it's really good. So I highly recommend it.
Is that something that's easy to get for people that have never seen it? Is that streamable? Is that on one of those? Do you know if it is? Or
I don't know if it's streaming, but Universal Archive has it for sale on DVD. That's where we got it.
Yeah, that's where we got it.
Right, right. That's one of those DVD companies where you basically they didn't pre-print a whole bunch. You make an order and they basically make a duplicate. They make one for you and send it to you. And it's not that expensive. It's 12
right.
bucks or something
and,
like that.
And Warner Brothers does the same thing. And that's how we got Genesis 2.
Right.
Which
yeah.
We also.
These were Roddenberry shows post
yes.
Star Trek, pre
yes.
Star Trek The Next Generation. There was the Questor tapes.
Yes.
Genesis 2 and Planet Earth, which was almost a remake of Genesis 2, correct?
Yeah, but not done as well.
Right, right.
Our understanding is that Genesis 2 was sold as a pilot, or was made as a pilot. It didn't sell, so they tried to retool it much as they did for the original Star Trek, and that didn't sell. And then ultimately, they made a couple of episodes without Roddenberry's involvement, and those are even less successful, sadly.
Yeah. And those are available on Warner Archive. And yeah, they're like 12 bucks or something. It's you know, not just curiosity. It's like, they're good stuff, you know, especially looking back now where, because you can see sometimes sort of the roots or trace elements of later Star Trek in some of these earlier projects, like Questor tapes especially has a lot of what kind of...
Well, Questor and Data. There
right.
you go. I mean... but Robert Foxworth is brilliant as Questor. It's really, again, we really like it. And we've known Bijou for, you know, a long time. And so we very much wanted to, you know, honor her. I mean, in making that statement, we wanted to honor her as well.
Cool, cool. Well, listen, I know that you guys got to run. We've taken a lot of your morning up. But before we do, you have been involved, like, you know, in Star Trek since the 1980s, Star Trek IV, Star Trek VI. And, you know, the new show will be coming out next year. And correct me if I'm wrong, you were not involved in any sort of formal way with the new show. So this is the first one in a long time that you'll be watching just as fans, correct?
Yeah, it's on one hand, yeah, we absolutely would have loved to work on it, but it's being shot in Toronto. But there is something very special about being able to tune in and to know nothing about it, to go, oh my God, is he going to make it?
Right.
So we are looking forward to our being able to watch it purely as fans.
And we worked with Brian Fuller on Voyager and like him a lot. And so, you know, we have high hopes. Yeah, we would have liked to have worked on it. But again, we like our home and they're filming in Toronto. So
it's, you have served Star Trek well for many decades. You don't owe Star Trek anything. You've created a visual language of the future. I mean, all like I said, people don't even realize, you know, there are screensavers. You know, licensed or unlicensed out there that are taken from your work, from your vision and how you incorporated your art into Star Trek. So like I say, you guys don't owe the show anything. You deserve to be able to watch one as fans at this point.
Well, we obviously love Star Trek a great deal. And one of the things that we very much enjoy about the Gene Roddenberry universe. It is a universe with hope and optimism. And on this planet, especially right now in the United States, there's a lot of talk of hate and isolation, and really is wonderful to be able to believe in something that's hopeful. And we hold that very dear to us. And we believe that the community of Star Trek aficionados, fans, people that really enjoy it, kind of hopefully carry that out into their daily lives. And that can just make this world a better place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I really hope that the new show, and I mean, all signs point to this, that the new show isn't just going to be another television adventure. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff on TV. You know, people say Westworld is great, and I haven't gotten around to it yet. It's episode 3 just showed last night, and I'm sure it's terrific, but I don't know that it's going to, you know, I don't know that it's going to save our country. I don't know that it's going to heal us because there's so much bad mojo in the air. And I think that Star Trek, this new show, you know, not entirely facetiously, I think is going to help calm us down a little bit. I really do think it has the potential to do that. So, yeah, the show can't come fast enough as far as I'm concerned.
Star Trek has always pointed us to a better tomorrow, and for whatever inspiration it provides, we're very, very proud to be part of that.
Excellent, excellent. Well, listen, like I said, I know you guys got to run, but I mentioned it briefly. You know, there was one space shuttle mission in real life. We're not talking Star Trek, where you guys were involved from a design point of view. Can you mention that real quick? How the heck? When that you got that phone call, did you think a friend was pranking you? I mean, how did that work out? This wasn't that long ago either, right?
You're talking about the STS-125 mission of Space Shuttle Atlantis. It was the last Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission. The lead spacewalker on that mission is an astronaut and scientist named John Grunsfield. And he was NASA's chief scientist, and he came out of retirement to go up to Hubble one last time to help fix one of the greatest scientific instruments of all time. And one day he contacted me and said, hey, would you be interested in designing the mission patch that we'll wear on our spacesuits? And I said, oh, yeah, I think so. And so one day we were chatting, and he said, hey, you know, one of the reasons I became an astronaut and a scientist was because I wanted to be like Mr. Spock. And how cool is that?
Yeah.
Michael has actually done quite a bit for NASA. He's done many different patches and logos for different departments. There was a proposed mission called Constellation, and which would have taken us back to the moon and then on to Mars. Sadly, it was canceled. But Michael did a lot of work on that. So again, our love of the real space program melds completely with our love for Star Trek.
Awesome. Well, listen, the book is available in stores tomorrow. This episode will be going live out there in the podcast universe on Wednesday, so it will have been out for a day, but tomorrow is when it shows up in stores. Are you guys going to be driving around to local stores to check out where it is, or are you going to be saying it's done, it's out there, I don't want to think about it right now?
We will be following it online. People have been posting pictures. It's already actually out in a couple of stores that it probably shouldn't be,
Uh-oh.
But people have been sending pictures, so that's really cool. We love when people show pictures of the book on either their shelves or our bookshelves.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, you know what? If you're listening to this show and you buy the encyclopedia either at a bookstore or via Amazon or one of those things, take a photo and tweet it. You guys are both on Twitter, correct?
Correct.
And, you know, you're easy to find on Twitter. You can tweet it at me, and I can tweet it at them, and we could all celebrate.
We'll all retweet it.
We'll all retweet it, and, you know, you got to make some space, but it deserves it. This is Star Trek, and this is, you know, this is it. This is the 50th anniversary. This is the encyclopedia. This is the base of knowledge. If Star Trek is something that puts an emphasis on education and knowledge and thinking, you need to start with this. So, you know, make some room. You know, the book ain't cheap, but it's worth every penny. And, you know, find it and take a great photo and we'll retweet it for you. That's the deal that we're making.
That sounds like fun, actually.
There you go. All right, guys. Well, congratulations again. And I'm sure we'll see you at the next convention. Until then, thanks so much. And if you like, I'll beam you out again. You know, we hopefully, you know, we won't be destroying your consciousness, just moving your atoms around. How does that sound?
Just be gentle.
Okay, you got it. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.